And I introduce the next speaker, Katie Chukrov. She is an associate professor at the Department of Cultural Theory at the Russian State University for the Humanities in...
Not anymore. School of Economy.
I'm sorry, this is the information I got about you.
No, but I sent another information.
Interesting. So, organizers, where are you? You are at the Higher School
of
Economy in Moscow. But are you still the head of the theory department at the National Center for Contemporary Art? That's good. Among her research interests are comparative epistemologies of socialism and capitalism, political theory, and post-human studies. She has published widely on art theory, cultural politics, and philosophy. She's currently finishing her book on the interpretation of the notion of the ideal in the Soviet Marxist philosophy of the 60s and 70s. So please, it's your turn now.
Thank you. I thank organizers Hakave, Anselm, Anton, and Boris Groys for invitation and for organizing this venue, which is quite risky and quite controversial. Nevertheless, it allows opportunity to check this notion of cosmism, which can go into very obscurant direction, which can as well show us some alternative modes of emancipation. And yesterday when we were talking and joking a little bit, we thought what would happen if immortality is already established and if everyone becomes immortal and whether there would be some dissident group and what would be this dissident group that don't want to be immortal, this would be some suicide team and organizers. And it's interesting that Alexei talked exactly about this destructive alternative that paradoxically becomes constructive, but very paradoxically, and probably my paper will to some extent deal with this issue as well. The paper is called Anagogia in Cosmism and Communism. Anagogia is a Greek term which is translated as ascent, as leading above, as going up, and it definitely has ecclesiastical context, but let's see how it could help us to research the topic of cosmism and communism. Reconsideration of Russian cosmism is important for three main reasons. In the conditions of harsh localization, when even decolonization and emancipation are exerted with the lexicons of identity politics, and when planetary theories recur to quasi-indigenous mythologies, cosmism provides an example of a universalist and cosmopolitan dimension. As Boris Groys claims it, cosmism allows to acquire perspective exceeding the globe in the conditions of the failed imaginaries of ultra-globalization. Second reason of referring to it, despite radical technical and biophysical experimentation, cosmism never discards the role of the human, preserving her subjectivity, even when such human is drastically changed by evolutionary or biogenetic transformations. Third reason, cosmism developed the edifice of commons that, along with strong ties with Christianity and ecclesiastical eschatology, has many affinities with the communist project. Meanwhile, the problem of cosmism is that although it actually got detached from confessional religion, never having become fully practice of social emancipation, it never became philosophic thought either. That's probably the reason why it remained a mixture of theological edification and scientific and technological research, reminding at times positivist biopolitics. The divergences of cosmism with communist premises and Christian dogmas are very important, but I will start with affinities. As we remember, Nietzsche solved the problem of the petty bourgeois Philistine life via promoting extreme nihilism of an overhuman who detaches from the society in the heights of sovereign power. An overhuman, as well as Faust, ascend away from humankind to contemptuously decry the shallowness of mere life, Bloßes Leben. Marxist mode is the antipode of such program. In it, the political ascent and cognitive breakthrough is programmed socially and collectively by and for the collective subject, when the ascent, the cognitive, social, and existential becomes possible for the most dispossessed. The Christian premise is similar to the Marxist in that Christ, despite being God, consents to be like the most belittled, humiliated, and diminished humans. It is in this sense that Nietzsche's overhuman is Antichrist. Thus, the cognitive excellence and nihilist elevation of Nietzsche's overhuman or of Faustian Prometheanism are different from the anagogical ascent of the saints, of Christ, of communists via utmost diminution of oneself and dissolution among every man. Thus, cosmism is important in its standing between the two most extreme methods of universalization, Christianity and communism, the projects of not allowing us to live mere life, even in Benjaminian sense, because for him, mere life is not bare life, as it was then interpreted by Agamben, but more just life, merely life, which is just simple life, and it's really shameful to live simply life. And then he inserts this divinity of violence which fosters us to exceed this mere life. The idea of ascent, the anagogical direction, is teleological, expedient, purposeful. Yet it is well known to what extent teleology had been under suspicion as the form of idealism and as discourse of power in the post-war Western philosophy. In Althusser's treatment of Marx and Hegel, in psychoanalysis, in its critique of superego and redemption, in post-structuralist studies, teleology speaks on behalf of coercion and despotism. From Sartre up to Lacan, Deleuze and Foucault, virtue can only be false. Hence, resistance to virtue should only be demonic and vicious. And Boris Groys talked and wrote on this issue as well. Exceeding the viciousness of power by an alternative creative vice, estranging of the estranged, alienating the already alienated, becomes the path of modern emancipation. Suspendedness and groundlessness, as with Sartre and Nancy, decomposition and dissociation, as with Guattari, recurring back into the Plato's cave instead of leaving this cave, as with Deleuze, welcoming chaos of osmos, aleatorix, and coup d'etat of fatum instead of prescribed order, as with Pierre Boulez, all these epistemes constructed the critical thought of resistance and liberation after 1968. Very important in this epistemology is, of course, the symbolic context of fall and its treatment. The fallenness becomes the protest against the phallogocentric erectility of a figure of father, man, logos, language, discipline. The fallenness is associated with the most oppressed and the exploited. The fallen and the deviating man and his subversive body becomes the most creative body, the dissensus of which is exerted in the male volant aesthetization of the fall. Hence, the commons in this condition become defense by the fallen of their right to fall apart, to dissociate, and claim various modes of falling as the resisting solipsism in the otherwise totally optimized social infrastructure. And there's a wonderful book by André Lepecki, Exhausting Dance, where he is ruminating about this necessity to be fallen apart in dance in this body which is never choreographed because choreography is the discipline of military command. A good metaphor of the fallen in this case could be the Lumpenproletariat as it had been described by Marx in his On the 18th of Brumaire. Let's imagine, nevertheless, that instead of critique of this social group as the miserable outcast of bohemian bourgeoisie, which according to Marx could only emancipate if it grew consciously into proletariat, let's imagine that we declare that the social degradation of this group is already the conscious choice, already resistant agency of them to indulge in the further decadent decomposition as their right to enjoy the degrading voluntary ethical fall. I think one who went this year to Documenta could observe this aesthetics. One can immediately bring forth as the counter-argument to the ethico-aesthetics of the fall, the productionist and Promethean theories of acceleration or of augmented post-human intelligences. However, along with affinities with cosmism, theories of acceleration differ from it in that they claim progress and development by means of further alienation and dehumanization. Cosmology in this case implies totalization of the outside, hence parallels of accelerationism with nihilism of Nietzsche, with the figure of Faust, whereas the exemplary characters of cosmism are Christ and Cordelia, the agents of devotion. The social ideal of cosmism is the de-alienated, not alienated, but de-alienated view of the universe, which is rather a form of common inhabiting than a void that is infinitely expanded and conquered by advanced intelligence. Cosmos of Russian cosmism is finite, not infinite. For post-war Western thought, de-alienation is the form of redemption and is unimaginable in the conditions of alienated labor. Meanwhile, in cosmism, kinship as radical form of de-alienation is essential. It evolves as the purposefulness of labor in achieving de-alienated commons globally. And communism also believes in de-alienation in case division of labor and private property are eradicated. In both cases, cosmism and communism, the goal is not merely the expansion of intellect, but achieving the overall de-alienated communization for which technological means, technological breakthroughs would just become the means. What is clear from this concise comparison of cosmism and communism is that emancipation is reconsidered here as into the project of anagogia, ascent, project of virtue, which substitutes obsessive subversive resistance to evil rather with incessant and fervent assertion of virtue, assertion of good, and Marina mentioned it. It doesn't mean that such assertion goes smoothly, but that logically the project of virtue and de-alienation is accomplishable and implementable. As we remarked, cosmism has alignments with Christian theology and communism. Nevertheless, it has serious deviations with it. It is very important that deviation for Christianity in cosmism coincides with its deviation from communism. And I will now deal with this and try to show how it works. As already many times had been repeated here, the obsession of Fyodorov and many others had been that immortality is not just a biotechnological achievement of longevity of body, but it's the acquisition of sinlessness, actually. They really believe that what is predicted by second advent of Christ is implementable and accomplishable here in mundane life by means of constructed commons of labor. But the idea is that the paradise condition can be reclaimed and organized on behalf of God. So let's see what is wrong here theologically and from the point of view of the Institute of Christian Faith. The common task issue, when you forget about the sermons of mysteries and liturgies of ecclesiastical practice, but start a labor common process of organization and regulation. So let's see how it correlates with the Institute of Christian Faith. The problem of cosmism is in preserving the authority of God, but daring to effectuate God's task, neglecting the sermons of God's grace. As I mentioned, in Russian it's blagodat, in Latin it's caritas. As we remember, Fyodorov keeps the role of God, but nevertheless, he makes humanity capable of divinity in advance, in situ, hic et nunc, merely projecting the engineering of universal liturgy on behalf of divinity. However, in Christian services, this is impossible, since grace is acquired not via Promethean boldness, but via humble resignation. No matter how righteous and laborious the immortality worker had been, when she stands before God, the remittal of sins is not dependent on the amount of achievement and the quantity of the build, but on the intensity of repenting heart, сокрушённое сердце, hearts being crushed. So we don't know whether the sins will be atoned. Only God can show us whether they will be atoned. We can think that we are laborious in goodwill deeds, but it doesn't mean that God thinks so or Christ thinks so. Maybe those people who seem to us sinners, maybe their sins will be atoned faster and better. So anagogia for a Christian is mainly awareness of this weakness, that sins cannot be regulated. And Fyodorov exactly doesn't touch upon the subtle existential components of liturgy, because he believes that it's some kind of obsolete part of church life. And generally, I was thinking that probably all those religious philosophers and cosmists, it would be good if instead of being considered as philosophers, they could organize some kind of Lutheran reformation of Orthodox Church. This would be really great, but unfortunately, this didn't happen. Meanwhile, if we refer back to the sermons, Christian sermons, anagogia for a Christian is the awareness of failure. It is rather the move that takes place. So anagogia is not a straightforward ascent, but it's the move that takes place despite failure. And the embodiment of this constant self-resignation is the statement from New Testament. Everyone knows it. It's blessed are the poor of spirit. And classical interpretation is that this is desperate inability of doing anything without God's mercy. Whatever is done can only be ascribed to God's generosity. So one is blessed for all the time lacking the spirit, for all the time lacking love. Because before Christ arrives, before the second advent, we are always in lack. We are in the lack of spirit, in the lack of love, in the lack of any accomplishment. And that's why being poor in this lack, we are honest and we are blessed by God, whose generosity can only allowing us to endure this constant lack and help us with this perseverance in anagogia. So in this logic, resurrection would be impossible in this idea of Fyodorov's total liturgy, because how can Christians resurrect when they always lack what is necessary for this resurrection as the fuel for this engineering, spirit and love? We don't have Christ's love and Christ's spirit. And if you remember the communist characters of Andrei Platonov's writing, the real communists are exactly those who are also poor of communism. And Alexei was also mentioning this weird idea of communism when you understand it via destruction and weakness and precarity. So his characters are those who ever lack communism so much that they feel themselves not sufficiently communism. They constantly lack communism. And what is then doubtful with cosmism is its non-dialectical and excessively optimized confidence, deprived of ruptures and paradoxes. The unsolved issue of communism is that positing initially the goal theurgically, that is, as the conquest of sin and synergetic assimilation with Christ, it concentrates mainly on biophysical and biotechnical optimization. And Christianity as the goal becomes then unattended, whereas philosophy as the dialectical paradoxalization of social being happens to be eradicated in favor of total planning too. Meanwhile, what Christianity, communism, and philosophy have in common Is the eschatology conditioned by event? And by the way, when Alexei was finishing his talk, he mentioned this radical event. Nuova Vita in Christianity, Communism, and Philosophy is not programmed, planned, or organized, but its eschatology is erupting from the irreversibility of the event. Both philosophy and theology can only confirm the truthful via eventual procedures, not merely prescribed design of these procedures. For Christianity, such radical eschatological event is crucifixion, resurrection, and second advent. For communism, such event is social revolution and the inevitability of the dictatorship of proletariat. This eventality can be treated and organized philosophically, dialectically, revealing constant doubts, paradoxes, and contradictions, but it can as well become positivist speculative design, as it happens often in contemporary techno-futurisms. And of course, I don't want to say that cosmism is confined to some kind of technological mechanicist planning, but what is lacking in it is something from what philosophy starts, the rupture between being and consciousness, and this contradiction and this juxtaposition of being and consciousness was the kernel of dialectical materialism and generally of philosophical dialectics. The reason why Lenin and many other socialist Marxists didn't accept Bogdanov's positivism was that they quite in the vein with Hegel insisted that natural sciences had an important impact and function, but technology and sciences could not supersede philosophy. Marxist premise according to which being is independent from consciousness and being defines consciousness presupposed a specific philosophic gnosiology. It meant that things are not literal. They are biased by Andersein in Hegelian sense, the other determined non-self being. As Ilyenkov claims, quoting Lenin's critique of empiricism and Bogdanov, hydrogen and electron and the gnosiological issues of cognizing hydrogen and electron are not identical. That's why merely data cannot be cognized without gnosiological means of generalization and its contradiction. And the main the idea of Lenin's critique is against Bogdanov's isomorphism, as well as then Ilyenkov's book when he comments on Lenin's critique of Bogdanov, when he's against techno-naturalist isomorphism between biological, mechanicist, physicist laws, so that they are applied then to organize social life. But we know that it became quite applicable in contemporary theories of ecto-network theory, in speculative realism and accelerationism, in ideas of speculative design, so it had its own path. But this argument is about inability of simply data of scientific experiment to stand for objective truth. So the fight of communism was ever for objective truth. And Ilyenkov's argument is that pure experience is not objective. It remains subjective. And why he criticizes Bogdanov, he's saying that the false objectivity of his technology and his organizational edifice is biased by subjective psychics. And only afterwards, the data of his subjective psychic experience are extrapolated into social and economic realia. So the problem was that if in classical dialectics, social being defines consciousness, in Bogdanov's construction, consciousness and being remain simultaneous and are literally identical. Two more logical points. The main thing when we talk about immortality, resurrection, about cloning, about applying the theories of artificial intelligence, is that we can do many things technologically, we can do many things biophysically, biotechnologically, but what remains the problem is consciousness. And what is consciousness? Can we resurrect consciousness? We can resurrect body, we can combine these atoms, etc. We can do technological emulations, but can consciousness be emulated? And the idea of Florensky was, for instance, this theory of sphragistics, that despite the fact that material atoms are dispersed, every atom of each body is bearing the imprint of soul. So each atom that is dispersed in the universe can be automatically gathered by the imprint of soul that will gather these bodily atoms. And actually, Fyodorov is not mentioning it, but in Fyodorov you can also understand this, that the main thing is the labor of material resurrecting, but the consciousness will somehow be entailed into this. And here is the idea of dialectics that would make it impossible, because the Marxist response of Ilyenkov or of Vygotsky to this allegation would be that consciousness is not psychic or a sensory category. It's definitely personified, but its construction is molded by objective external sociality of the world, which is independent of consciousness. This is the main tragedy of being and of these dialectics of being and consciousness. The idea of objective reality forming consciousness is the kernel of dialectics, then it would be merely impossible to resurrect the individual consciousness, since it is not psychic life of a person, but the whole complexity of this other determined non-self or other self being, Andersein, invested and realized in concrete historical conditions. How can one resurrect consciousness when the external everything that constructed it is forever lost? Because consciousness is not just psychic personal category, it's the historical condition and complexity of everything around it that is reflected and imprinted on consciousness. Then resurrection in this case could be only biophysical, and what we could get would be a zombie or a biorobot. And the last allegation and the rhetorical question with which I want to finish is the following. What if we already have the access to immortality? What if we are already immortal? In cosmism, immortality is to a considerable extent projected as physical maintenance. The struggle against death and physical longevity is definitely necessary. I completely support it. However, it would be a logical mistake to deny that immortality can exist despite mortality. The reason is simple. As long as immortality, both as physical eternity and divine grace, has not yet been achieved, it would be cruel to deprive us, humankind, of its ethical attempt in claiming immortality within our mortality and despite our mortality. Actually, this was the condition that gave birth to philosophy. And Alexei started with this, destruction. The idea that destruction is inevitable brings us the idea of philosophy. Philosophy teaches to die, as Socrates defines for his disciples when he's dying, when he has already drunk the hemlock, and he's dying and his disciples are surrounding him. He's in the dialogue Phaedo telling that at last he's dying, convalescence, great. But it is such philosophic readiness to mortality that paradoxically asserts conceptual, logical, ideational immortality. Learning to die for a philosopher means loving life. It means capacity to paradoxically assert life without and beyond life. And it is the philosophic ethics of the acceptance of death that establishes the conceptual ideational immortality. Similarly, we can see such condition in Christian patristics, perishability and imperishability, ruminations about imperishability despite perishability, voluntary mortality by the immortal is a cliché of numerous science fiction plots and movies too. For example, in Kubrick's Artificial Intelligence, an immortal cyborg sacrifices his immortality in order to once again meet his deceased mother. So immortal cyborgs choose to be become mortal humans for the sake of love to mortals. And then becoming mortal on behalf of the immortal establishes new kind of ideational, conceptual supramortality. And actually, this is what Christ is doing. In fact, Christ played the role of such an immortal cyborg who chose dying as mortals for the sake of his love towards each and every mortal human being, thus giving them chance also to become a little bit immortal. In other words, Christ's act also becomes immortality within consent to death. The idea of infinity, despite finitude, was excellently developed by Evald Ilyenkov in his Cosmology of Mind, and Alexei talked about it, and it's a fantastic work, really, that I completely agree that it causes astonishment and amazement, but what is really fantastic, this idea of human mind performatively destroying the universe, but for the sake of new matter arising in other galaxies. So the idea is that the solar system is perishable and destruction is inevitable, but instead of waiting for this cooling, thermal cooling, the human mind, which is the extension of matter, will effectuate this destruction so that the new matter is born somewhere else. But the optimistic idea I hear wouldn't agree with Alexei maybe completely. You say that it's the project of negativity in communism. I think that Ilyenkov overcomes this negativity of destruction by saying that, okay, the developed, already mature communist human mind and humankind knows that the matter is destructible. They will effectuate this explosion. But then look, in other galaxies, the matter is born. But what is the extension of matter? It can ever be only mind. And since mind is only human mind, humankind is everlasting. So anywhere in any other galaxy, the humankind will be born again, because matter inevitably entails mind, spirit, and humankind. This is crazy, but this probably some kind of communist way of dealing with this entropy issue. But even more important in this idea of destruction and inevitability of death is the dialectics of being and consciousness, that consciousness knows that being is more important, and instead of being itself, consciousness wants to be its undersign, its other self, its non-self. Consciousness, being itself, wants to be the other. So the dialectical tragedy of being is, as Ilyenkov states it, that human mind is only a little part of matter, but nevertheless it's inevitable necessity. But at the same time, mind and consciousness are all the time aware that they are dependent on matter and dependent on its own non-self and on the agency of being to destroy it. So in such conceptual acceptance of one's non-self being, one allows humble acceptance of mortality, but this asserts one's own general logical immortality. And if we look what happens in Christianity, in patristics, who will be resurrected, actually, if we look at the idea of resurrection? Actually, maybe those who will be resurrected in Christianity, in Second Advent, would not be our earthly we or our earthly me, but this would be those universal selves who, by means of anagogia, had reached their metanoia of other selves had reached their non-selves. And actually, Boris Groys talked about metanoia yesterday. So the idea is that what is resurrected is not individual personal self, but the non-self, the other self. And exactly this other self allows us to assert the paradoxical, philosophical, ideational immortality. Thanks.